Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Virginia Education Association, the men and women working in Virginia's public schools. VEA, teaching, learning, leading. Online at veanea.org.
Our changing language, the new words added to our lexicon in 2013. I'm May Lily Lee, and this is Virginia Conversations. Politics and pop culture are always drivers of new words and phrases, and last year didn't disappoint. Obamacare, selfie, and twerk weren't the only words in the spotlight. We'll hear about many more and discuss common grammar faux pas. Joining us from the studios of WVTF in Roanoke is a true Virginia treasure who tracks the evolution of our language. Welcome lexicographer, reference book author, and editor, Ann Sukhanoff. Welcome, Ann.
Hi, how are you? Good to see you.
Great to have you back. And I was thinking about this. When you filled out applications and the forms ask for your profession, do you write in there, word expert?
I say lexicographer and in parentheses put dictionary editor, because many people have no idea what a lexicographer is.
Next time you do it, I dare you to misspell lexicographer.
Some people probably wouldn't know the difference.
When we spoke about this show, that is the big new words for 2013, you said that the three biggies were Obamacare, selfie, and twerk.
Yes, I did, yeah.
The highest profile ones, that is.
Yes, but not necessarily the most important ones that are predictive or reflective of our society as it's headed and in the ways that it has behaved in the past.
And that leads us to a very important one that may not be in the headlines. Let's talk about O-L-I-N-G-U-I-T-O.
Yes, a linguito. It's a Spanish word, and it means little a lingo, which is actually a small raccoon. In our great society, with all the communications that we have worldwide and within the country, somehow we missed a reddish-brown nocturnal mammal that's indigenous to the mountain forests of Ecuador and Colombia, and it's about 14 inches long with an equally long tail, weighs 2 pounds, eats fruit and has one offspring at a time, and is the smallest member of the raccoon family. And we know that it was discovered and noted scientifically on the exact date, which was August 15th, 2013. The interesting thing about this is that the alinguito was well known to all of the indigenous peoples in those parts of South America, but yet we in our scientific community had misinterpreted what it was, thought it was part of the pre-existing alingo species. And so now it has its own scientific binomial. And you may think that a little animal like that is of totally no importance at all to us, but it really sort of illustrates what William Gass said in Harper's Magazine in 2004. He said, "To meet new words is to encounter new wonders." And that's the way I feel about all the new words that have come into the language this year and in past years, that you are introduced to new wonders in science, in medicine, in culture, in international affairs, and law, among just a few of them.
I spoke with an architect once who said his job pulls in so many different veins of study and thought, from environmental studies to the ecology to design to engineering. I imagine that as a lexicographer, there's something similar for you.
It certainly is. We actually record what is going on in society, in all aspects of society, when we study the language and look at sense development of pre-existing words, which is called metastasis, or when we see actually new coinages coming into the language. And we're able to detect these new coinages almost in real time nowadays because of the existence of big data. And go ahead.
No, go ahead. That's continue that thought.
What I thought was interesting was in looking at all the new words, I tried to sort of see what sort of societal trends we're in right now, because they are signs of the times and signs of the future. And I noticed that the words that are coming into the language now, such as big data, which we dealt with last year, and some of the others that are on the small side, such as mini jobs, microloans, click farms, and laptop lending, actually represent the difference between power and the powerless, and the haves and the have-nots. And so that's one trend that I have seen, just based upon the words that we have looked at in 13 and in 12 as well. And then on the other hand, we are always interested, particularly in the computerized world, with preserving privacy. And deep state and deep web and big data counteract those concerns right there. So we have a lot of tension in society. We all know that. But the words in the language are as roiled as society is right now. Everything's very unstable, very uncertain, and you can get that eerie feeling as you look at the words that have come into the language just recently.
Another feature that makes a word like olinguito stand out is that we know who named it. That's not always the case.
That's right. Yes, there were scientists from, I believe, the Smithsonian who traveled down to South America and actually observed this animal finally for the first time. And before that, people had tried to breed it with the olingos. I think I mentioned that before, and they would not breed. So they discovered scientifically, this is a different species.
And let's say that I wanted to live in infamy, and I wanted to create my own word, something that was attributable to me, something that I author. What's the best way of making that happen?
Well, you have to come up with a word that fills a lexical void. And I have one here that is very important. It was coined, actually, by Anne Dowsett Johnson, who is a former editor of the Canadian magazine Maclean's, and also had been a vice principal at McGill University in Canada. She has written a book called Drink, The Relationship Between Women and Alcohol, which was just published in 2013. And in that book, she used the word alcogenic, A-L-C-O-G-E-N-I-C, which is a blend of alcohol plus the suffix genic, which comes from the Greek genes, which means produced or generated by. And the definition that I have come up with, based on what she has said, would be encouraging, producing, or characterized by alcohol abuse. And here is her quotation. "We live in an alcogenic culture where risky drinking has been normalized." Now, there is no other word that I know of that covers that particular aspect of what's going on in society so well and so precisely. That's a very serious word. But then there's another one that's really funny, and I'm sure everybody in the audience who's ever dealt with somebody who is addicted to a smartphone has experienced this. It's called fubbing. Have you ever been fubbed at a party recently? Chances are you've fubbed at least once in your life if you're addicted to a cell phone. Are you an inveterate fubber? Are you guilty of fubbing?
Who gave us fubbing?
Okay. It was a group of scholars.
That's hard to believe.
Oh, yes. But they were Australians.
The best they could come up with is not something multisyllabic, you know, like disestablishmentarianism. They come up with something monosyllabic like fub.
Yes, and it's a blend of phone plus snub. And they were Australians, of course. What it means, I'll give you the meaning and then I'll tell you how it came about. This is an example of a word that has taken off, by the way, by means of social media, and it probably will get into the dictionary just like alcogenic will. It means to ignore somebody else, for example, in a social setting, by looking at your smartphone instead of looking at your interlocutor or paying attention to that other person. And It was invented in May of 2012, actually, by a team of specialists at Sydney University, but it was picked up by the advertising firm McCann Melbourne in order to help, of all things, them to promote a sixth edition of an Australian dictionary. And this is the first time in the history of lexicography that I know of that a word was coined to advertise a dictionary, sort of in stealth advertising, and then it became an artifact of the language. And it's working its way in very, very quickly. What they did was they had a very aggressive social media push program where they were pushing the dictionary, and they created little scenarios about fubbing, and they used the word fub all over the place. And then at the very end, you found out that they were talking about a new dictionary. And it was a very clever advertising campaign. But it also, at the same time, and they may not have even known that this was going to happen, they fulfilled a need in the language to describe a very irritating and pervasive habit.
And I remember sending you an email, and I was half joking. I said, I've got a new word. I've got a new one. And I wrote it out for you just like it might appear in the dictionary. Narcissize. It's a word I came up with after studying, becoming somewhat intrigued by narcissists. So I decided to make it a verb. And my definition, if it were to ever happen, would be to behave in a narcissistic fashion toward another person. Example, Dave narcissized Jane on their first date.
Wonderful. I think you stand a very good chance of getting that into the mainstream language if people pick up on it, because we do live in the age of new narcissism, for sure.
Here's another one, and this is used as a noun, after war, but not mine. This is a real word.
Yeah. Yeah, this is a very important one that came about in 2013. And again, we know that the coiner is David Finkel, who wrote Thank You for Your Service. It was a book that was published this year, and the citation that I picked up for it came from the New York Times Book Review of December 29th, 2013. After war is a noun. It's not an adjective. It's formed like after party. And the definition that I've constructed for it, based on his citation, is the repercussions, visible and hidden, of combat. And here is his quotation, which is very significant. Quote, every war has its after war, its consequences and reminders. And so it is with the wars of Iraq and Afghanistan, which have created some 500,000 mentally wounded American veterans, a number that will have an impact on U.S. society, politics, medical care, and the overall economy for years to come. So I think that that one, definitely because of the times that we live in and the way that it expresses a situation that has never really had such a succinct descriptor, I think that this word definitely will probably get into new dictionaries.
I think this next word will resonate with many. Mini job.
Yeah, now this is really interesting. This is not babysitting for your neighbors or putting up a lemonade stand in the summer. It's actually it's of a piece of cluster of words that are sort of are very diminutive regarding certain aspects of our society. And again, it hearkens to the haves versus the have-nots, the 1% versus the working stiffs, whether they be in Southwest Asia or U.S. or in Germany. Mini-job actually refers to marginal employment in Germany per se that allows a person to make €450 or U.S. dollars $580 a month tax-free. And, of course, this helps their employers hold down their costs of benefits and salaries and so forth. And at the same time, it allows people who are desperate to have jobs to pick up a little bit of money, such as students, people who are retired, and those who can't get jobs full time. And 1 in 5 Germans, or 7.4 million of them, actually have many jobs. So this sort of belies the unemployment rate of 6.9% that was listed in May for Germany. In other words, it seems to me that it's rather unstable. It looks like a 6.9 or a 5.9. I think yesterday said 5% of unemployment. Looks pretty good. But when you consider that there are so many people in these mini jobs and they're getting subsidized by the government, it does not look like a strong economy overall. And the same thing has to do with Temp Town, which is one of our words. It came out in Time magazine in July of 2013. It's a locale in which a high percentage of the workers, mostly blue-collar people, are temps or even perma-temps. And they gave an example of Kane County, Illinois, in which 1 in 6 workers are temps or perma-temps. And, of course, when we look at our unemployment and employment figures, we have to take into account these people who have the mini jobs and are the perma-temps and the ones who are also working, for example, in click farms abroad. And, of course, we know that those are this was a new word this year. It's an organization that generates fake endorsements over social media sites such as Facebook, paying low-paid people to click like on a particular corporate site or on someone else's personal page for financial gain. And the employees in these low-paid click farms are anxious to get a few U.S. dollars. So this whole thing worries me. I worry about whether we don't have a Potemkin village of an economy if we have so many millions of people who are doing these things in order just to stay afloat.
Last year, you and I talked about a new word at the time, eve-teasing.
Yes.
Eve-teasing is a euphemism used in India for public sexual harassment or molestation of women by men, with use of the word eve being a reference to the biblical Eve. Well, you have a new one this year that's almost a cousin to this.
Yes, and this is in particularly in the United Arab Emirates. And we have citations for this from English language magazines in the Emirates themselves. Although this particular instance came from the May 2013 Wall Street Journal. It's camel hump. And it's also called camel hump hairdo. And especially in the...
I hear backlash.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. It's very controversial, by the way. In especially the United Arab Emirates, it's an elaborate hairstyle, woman's hairstyle, either a towering beehive or a large back projection called a gamboa, G-A-M-B-O-O apostrophe A in Arabic, created with pins, sponges, clips, and sometimes even milk cartons to indicate that the wearer has lots of long hair hidden under her veil, which is called a shala, because long hair is considered sexy, but has to be covered almost completely in the Arab world according to their quote-unquote look policy, which I'll get to in a minute. But it's a way of young women expressing their own individuality and of attracting male attention, and also it's a sign of independence.
Anne Sukhanov, lexicographer, reference book author, and editor. Such a pleasure to talk with you, and we will continue with more words. We're going to take this break and remind you that you're listening to Virginia Conversations. Stay with us. We'll have more word talk and your grammatical pet peeves after this break. And welcome back to the program. This is Virginia Conversations, and we're talking with lexicographer Anne Sukhanov. I want to turn to some grammatical pet peeves first. Some might call these grammatically acceptable, and others will call them peeves. So let's start with sort of a Southwest Virginia phrase, you might could. What do you think of that one, Anne?
Well, coming from these parts and also being a student of the language, I know that might could is actually technically called a double modal auxiliary. It sort of sounds like somebody double clutching a moonshine car, doesn't it? But when we use that technical term. But what it really is when they take two modal auxiliaries and combine them together. This is considered regional American English, specifically indigenous to all parts of the South, not just to the New River Valley or to just Virginia. It's perfectly acceptable in casual conversation amongst your peers, but it's certainly not good for airtime usage or written usage that's considered to be formal.
At the coffee shop this morning, I heard a woman on the phone with her wireless Bluetooth headset. She said he might have spoke with her.
Oh, dear. Yep. That's an incorrect usage of the verb speak. He might have spoken to her or with her, not
Great.
Spoke.
How about this one? A whole nother issue.
That goes back, I believe, I'm not sure, but I believe it goes back to the 1970s when it was used as a whole nother smoke. And I seem to remember it had to do with weed, as a matter of fact. And it was also, I believe, on Laugh-In.
And really?
We didn't have Budmasters in those days, but now they do out there in Colorado, I understand. But it's a contraction of another, and it's perfectly okay to use casually, but certainly, again, taboo for on the air and informal speech.
If it was in the hallway versus if it were in the hallway.
People don't understand the subjunctive, and there's no point in explaining it to them. All they need to know is if it's a condition that's contrary.
You're giving up on us. You're just giving up like that.
I'm just trying to explain it so they'll remember it, you know, so they can tattoo it on their minds. Condition contrary to actual fact. You have to say, you cannot say was or is. You have to say were. If I were a hammer, I would hit the nail on the head, but I'm obviously not a hammer. If I were in Siberia right now, I'd be colder than I am in Roanoke, Virginia. I'm sitting here.
So it really is improper to say if it was in the hallway. You really need to say if it were in the hallway.
Yeah, if it's not there, you need to say if it were.
Okay. Even more important versus even more importantly.
That is something that most people object to. It grates on the ear and the eye, and it should be more important rather importantly. And I think most dictionaries have a usage note to that effect.
I'll do one more before we take this next call. Nothing can be further from the truth. Nothing can be farther from the truth.
I've heard both. And this is a battle that I'm simply not going to put a dog into at this point because people really don't understand the subtle differences and the big differences between further and farther. I will put a dog in the fight about may and can and some of the others such as who and whom. When they are so badly misused. And I will put a dog in the fight about using so, the conjunction so, as a sentence opener, which is quite pervasive nowadays.
Now turning to our caller, as part of our plan toward world domination, this caller is in West Jefferson, North Carolina. Good morning to you, Howard.
Yes, good morning. I would like a guest's opinion on the legitimacy of the words functionality and directionality, because it seems to me you have the noun, you turn it into an adjective like functional, and then turn it back into a noun.
That happens all the time. It's called functional shift. It occurs in English constantly, such as the verb texting came from the noun text, and many also adding suffixes to words such as adjectives and turning them into nouns is quite common. It's one of the most prolific generators of words in the language, and particularly in science. The two words that you were talking about there have a sort of technical connotation to them without my even talking about what the meanings are.
Uh-huh.
So you see that constantly, and it's a perfectly normal formative process in the English language.
Oh, there's no desire for brevity. And when you already have a noun, So it is totally legitimate, those two words.
Yes, it is. And, for example, sequestration versus the noun sequester. You get the opposite feeling from a lot of people. You know, the noun sequester, in the sequester, or the sequester caused lots of problems with people in the who had jobs in the Department of Defense, that kind of quotation. Lots of people object to that because it's a clipping of sequestration. And so the thought is, if you can say it in fewer letters or fewer words, it's always better, but not necessarily.
Oh, okay. Okay, well, thank you.
Howard, I'm reading here, the average English speaker knows between 25,000 and 40,000 words. I'm thinking you know 50,000.
Well, I can read maybe 50,000.
We really appreciate your call, Howard.
Okay, thank you.
That was a great question, by the way.
Thank you so much. Dan from Blacksburg, good morning to you.
Yes, what really irritates me is that people's unable to use prepositions correctly. And instead of saying there are, et cetera, they say theirs. And I see it, I hear it all the time.
Give me an example, a sentence.
There's going to be 12 people tonight at the party.
Mm-hmm. So subject-verb agreement is not happening there.
Exactly, right. Or people saying for him and me, they say for him and I.
I was hoping you could give an example where I could say the word modal auxiliary and sound just like Anne.
He has a wonderful question, and I agree with him completely. There they go again is what I say. There is used as a false pronoun or noun, quite often as a false subject of a sentence. There is an adverb, and we're talking about T-H-E-R-E, and it creates a tremendous number of cluster problems when people misinterpret this adverb as a noun or pronoun. You get things like, quote, there is any number of reasons for that. And that actually came from the New Republic on the 2nd of, actually on the 25th of February 2013. If you take the real subject of the sentence, which is any number, and it's plural, and reverse the whole thing and put there in its place as an adverb, you know that you have to have a plural verb. Any number of reasons are there for that. And that's why people use the contraction theirs, T-H-E-R-E apostrophe S, which the caller objects to so much. That is a clear example where the user thinks it's a pronoun or a noun subject of a sentence when they have the wrong part of speech completely.
We go now to Roanoke. We have a call from Margaret. Good morning, Margaret.
Hey, good morning. How are you?
Just fine.
Great. Miss Anne, I have two or three pet peeves. I think one of them has been touched upon already, having to do with pronouns. It's actually more in the predicate nominative usage. For example, it was I who called. It was they who wrote the rule. People say it was me. It was them. That sort of thing.
Right. That's very common, especially in colloquial speech. For some reason, people seem to be very afraid of using I as a predicate nominative. I don't know why, but they do seem to be afraid of it, and they will substitute myself in other instances to get away from using the big I. But you're absolutely right. If someone calls up and says, may I speak to Sally, and Sally's at the phone, she says, it is I, not it's me. And the same thing holds for the other pronouns that you cited.
Correct. And just two other couple things that perhaps, a couple of things that perhaps you could comment on. And let's hope I can say these grammatically correct myself. One is, you will hear broadcasters say, for example, in reporting about President Obama, President Obama, he today ruled thus and so. Instead of just saying, President Obama today ruled that, they keep inserting that pronoun. Or you'll hear, for example, something like, the fires in California, they have just taken over the countryside instead of saying the fires in California have taken over the countryside.
Exactly. They're using an appositive there in the wrong way. You know, we used to teach our children to never say things like the dog, he ran into the neighbor's yard. It's very bad grammar.
I can remember my daddy correcting me so much at the dinner table that I was little on that very count. And lastly, and again, I hear this in broadcast news, and I wish I could think of an example right now, the confusion people have when using fewer and less.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I just heard that on MSNBC on a major, major show where the very, very well-known show host said early in the morning, a couple of days ago, in a discussion of the proposed minimum wage hike, that, small business people are going to hire less employees because of this. And they don't understand that few goes with count nouns and less goes with mass nouns. Again, all of these things that I'm hearing today are redolent of the fact that we're not teaching grammar, in my opinion, in the structured way that it should be in the school systems.
Perhaps you're right. I mean, in that respect, I don't have children in school, but I heard recently that grammar is now only taught in fourth and fifth grades. And, of course, when I was going to school, it was in every grade through high school.
The same thing happened with me. And, of course, I was also benefited by taking 4 years of Latin, which certainly helps a person to understand in the high school level anyway, an inflected language and all of the properties that grammar imposes upon the orderliness or disorderliness of the language. And not to put down the school systems altogether, children are spending an awful lot of time texting and using other electronic media, and they're not being read to as much by their parents as they used to be. So they're not getting by osmosis, in my opinion, examples of really good writing by respectable authors. And then they're not reading as much, as they probably used to, because there's so much outside stimuli.
Oh, how true that is. And when I was growing up, my mom read me every story from Uncle Arthur's bedtime stories. And, of course, I read to my kids every day before they started school. So,
well, that's great.
Yes.
Ellen, thank you so much for your call.
Thank you for letting me express these things that have been gnawing at me.
Absolutely. In fact, when you brought up the visual around your father at the dinner table, I imagined him removing some peas from your plate each time you were ungrammatical. Next call is Lynn from Atkins, West Virginia. Good morning, Lynn.
Good morning.
You're on the air.
Hi. I have a couple of pet peeves. I was just listening to the lady before, and she really touched me when she used the word gnawing, because I feel some of these things have just become so ubiquitous that I just want to scream. And I think this was, I think this was touched on earlier, using theirs, the contraction theirs, T-H-E-R-E apostrophe S, instead of using there are for a plural noun. Example, there's a lot of people.
Yes, we talked about that, yes.
Right. Now, I thought this was recent, but I was watching some old, Mary Tyler Moore, I really like her, I was watching some old episodes, and it was way back in the 70s this was happening. So how long has this been going on?
It's been going on for way too long. We have had usage notes about this particular misusage going back to the 60s.
Oh, my God. It makes me insane, because I'm saying, no, that's not modifying. You're using a lot. That's not what's modifying. You know, that's not your subject. You're wrong. And I found myself, like, yelling sometimes at the radio, and I'm sorry to say that many NPR reporters do it, which makes me very sad. My other one that I've noticed lately is the word evolve is also becoming prevalent in being used to signify change or transition. And if you think about evolve, it's a very specific use, going back to, you know, Darwinism. We're sitting there talking about, you know, random changes in, to create a new species. Is that really what people want to say, that our business program is evolving to accommodate new employees?
Yes, actually it is. And I think this may come from military use. I know that the noun evolution is used quite often in the Navy and in the Army to indicate changes, major changes in operational matters and things like that. And in business English, it's been a fixture. That sense of evolve has been a fixture for years and years and years.
Now, how do you feel about that use? Do you think that that's kind of swaying away from the original definition, or is it, are we cool with this?
I think we're cool with this. This is an example of metastasis, basically, which is sense evolution. I'm using the noun now just to describe that. We get the same sort of thing with, for example, physical, the adjective physical. It's developing, as we sit here, a new subsense, which is material as opposed to digital or electronic. A good example is a recent quote, physical retailers struggle to win shoppers. And likes to read physical books as opposed to digital books like Kindle and whatnot. So that kind of usage I wouldn't have any problem with.
Okay.
Lynn, thank you so much for your call this morning. We appreciate it. And we don't have enough time to go to Jim's call. We'll hold off on that until the break. But let's go ahead and at least introduce one more of the new words from 2013. Another one that's on your list, Anne, is deep state.
Yes, that sounds like a woo-woo word, doesn't it? Eerie. Maybe something that's been concocted by a conspiracy theorist. Well, it isn't. It's actually a unitary word that has its own meaning, and it goes all the way back to the Ottoman Empire, but it has become very new in 2013. It's defined as an impenetrable, imperceptible, unaccountable, secret, powerful level of interlocking government bureaucracies, including law enforcement, intel, political and financial agencies, and top officials that run a country, all the while maintaining and burnishing a patina of normalcy and democracy. And it goes back to Turkish.
Deep state. We're talking with Anne Sukhanov. On Virginia Conversations, this reminder that past editions of the show can be heard at virginiapublicradio.org. And find out about upcoming topics and comment on past ones on Facebook. Search for Virginia Conversations and like us. We'll be back with more in just a moment.
Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Virginia Education Association, supporting public discourse through sponsorship of Virginia Public Radio. Resources for parents and teachers online at veanea.org. More information about Virginia Conversations and other Virginia Public Radio programming can be found online at virginiapublicradio.org. This is Virginia Public Radio.
Welcome back to Virginia Conversations. I'm May Lily Lee. Today we're talking about grammar and our ever-changing language, or as we might say, the evolution of our language. Our guests include all of you who have been calling in, along with lexicographer Anne Sukhanov, joining us from the studios of WVTF in Roanoke. Jim, I promised that we would go to you. Welcome from Clifton Forge.
Hello. Good morning.
Good morning.
I have two things I'd like you to address for me, if you would, please. The first is the mispronunciation of the word mischievous. People add an extra syllable in and say mischievous. And the second is substituting a possessive for a plural. For example, the word shop, I'm going to the shops today, they would spell it S-H-O-P apostrophe S.
Oh,
I see that all the time.
I'm so glad you brought
that
up. I'm sorry to jump in. I just couldn't help it. The apostrophe is probably the most abused and misused little symbol in our entire orthographic system. And I want to start with that. people simply don't understand that they don't need to say, use a possessive when they say they're going to a certain location, such as the shop or to the dentist. I think what they think is it's an elision of I'm going to the dentist's office. So if they say I'm going to the dentist apostrophe S and there's nothing else there, they're assuming that they're going to the dental office. It's still not good. And especially when it's used like the caller has shown, I'm going to the shops. It's S-H-O-P-S if it's a group of shops, or if I'm going to the shop, it's S-H-O-P. Another really bad fault that I see all the time, if people send letters, particularly Christmas cards and things like that, to the Suhanovs, they will say, to the Suhanovs, and it'll be S-O-U-K-H-A-N-O-V apostrophe S. Or it'll be S apostrophe, and there shouldn't be one there at all.
I used to like to add to the madness. If I went to the supermarket, I would say, I'm going to Martins's, I'm going to Ucrops's.
Shame on you. How dare you do that?
What about mischievous and mischievous?
Those are pronunciation variants, and mischievous is what we call an overpronunciation.
But and it's wrong.
It's not exactly wrong. It's indigenous to certain parts of the country. I found that out from somebody who was a specialist in regional American English. But to me, it certainly grates on my ears. It's as though someone is pronouncing furniture, furniture, and column, column.
Mm-hmm. What about poinsettia and poinsettia?
Either one of those are okay. They're normal.
All right. Thanks so much for that call, Jim. And Karen, yeah.
Hey, may I comment on something you referenced earlier?
Only if it's nice.
It's nice. But I would like to put a dog in that hunt you referred to earlier. It's my understanding that you travel farther and further a cause.
That's true. That's true. But people do not understand the differences between those, just as they have trouble with the word fulsome, and they will misuse that. They simply don't understand these subtle differences anymore, and a lot of times that's how usage changes. For example, I'll give you a good example of this. A lot of times people objected in the 1960s to the verb contact, which is a functional shift from the noun contact. And usage panels, including the one that I used to manage, excoriated that kind of usage. Now it's perfectly acceptable. The language changes over time, sometimes not the way we want, but it does. And some of the things we have to just sort of live with on an individual basis. And, of course, you are free, certainly, not to use further and farther in the traditionally incorrect manner. And it's a good idea to pass it on to your children and grandchildren, those ideas. But, as opposed to something like irregardless, which is a totally rogue non-word, I think further and farther are not quite as bad as irregardless.
Jim, thank you so much
thank
for your call.
Much.
I started uttering the name of Karen, and we will get to you in a minute. But first, Ellen from Roanoke. Ellen, good morning.
Good morning. I have a question about the use of the verb to hire, as in getting someone to do something for you. I was talking with my husband a couple of years ago, and he made the comment that we needed something done at the house, and he said, well, I guess I could just hire it done. Now, we are both pretty good with grammar, but I had never heard that usage, and he maintained that his parents, who grew up in Middle Tennessee, would say that all the time. And he said, how would you say it? And I said, well, I would hire someone to do it for me. But their use of we could just hire it done, i.e. getting someone else to do it as opposed to doing it yourself, was something they absolutely felt was correct, and I balked at that.
I like the way it sounds. I'm going to start using it.
It's a regionalism again.
And it's
perfectly okay in that idiolect that they have, but it certainly would not be okay if you were doing a memorandum in a business, for example, or in other forms of formal English. But that's one of the things that I think people should familiarize themselves with more, and I'm talking about people all over the country, not just us here. There's a Dictionary of Regional American English, which is sort of the Oxford English Dictionary of American Regional English. It gives all sorts of dialect maps of across the country of who says what where. And it is absolutely fascinating to sit there and read through those volumes of that dictionary and see what people in the Piney Woods are saying and what the people in Tennessee are saying and what the people in Massachusetts are saying. Because even with the confluence of electronic communications, we still have dialect artifacts within our language. And I think that's good in a way. I mean, you know, Jonathan Yardley said in the Washington Post back in 2002, he said, "We borrowed our language from the British, but we have little patience for polishing our prose as they do, and none of their quaint affinity for bookishness." And we still have a little bit of our backwoodiness there. And I love it.
We appreciate your call, Ellen. And now we go to Charlottesville. Good morning, Karen. Hi, Karen. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my call. Two items I'm wondering if I'm just going to have to learn to live with. One is use of the word utilize when use will do. And the second one is some trends I've seen among teenagers in the way they use about and for. I'm excited about the concert. I'm excited for the concert. And I always tease my daughter and say, "Wow, I'm excited for the concert, too. Is it getting a new dress?" And also on accident and by accident is another case where I'm seeing teenagers using that turn of speech differently than I would have growing up. So I'm curious, are these trends that I'm just going to have to accept? Am I being too old-fashioned?
You're not being too old-fashioned with use and utilize, for starters. If you can say it in a less bureaucratic manner, go ahead and do the shorter, less bureaucratic form. I think most people would agree on that. As far as on accident and by accident, can you give me a context how that would be used?
I stepped on her foot on accident. In a way that I would have used on purpose growing up, I'm seeing people use on accident instead of by accident. And I don't know if that's a regionalism or just something that younger people are adopting.
Well, I think it's an ungrammatical adoption by young people. I think that one's actually wrong. And as far as about concert or for the concert, can you give me a context again on that a little bit more?
Again, if they're discussing an upcoming event, the kids will say, "I'm really excited for the prom," instead of "I'm really excited about the prom." And I'm seeing this in people of all ages, kind of starting at 35 and under. So I'm a little bit older, 50, and I'm wondering if this is just a change that we're all going to have to get used to.
I hope not.
I'm with you there. but
because it's sloppy, and it brings to mind this new use of because that the same group of people seems to be using. They'll say, "I'm late because traffic." And I'm beginning to wonder whether this isn't coming from texting. I don't know. But it was picked up by the American Dialect Society, actually, as their word of the year. And I was very sorry that they picked it up. I was hoping they would do deep state or deep web or something that had a little bit more oomph to it as far as society is concerned.
Okay, well,
Karen,
thank you so much.
Bye for now. That reminds me of Chinglish, and perhaps some people will be offended, perhaps not. But when you go to China, there are attempts at translating English. And so you come up with these hilarious signs. I'm looking at a few of them. "Do not disturb. Tiny grass is dreaming." There's a man and a woman figure, and that's probably for the restrooms, "Feman" and "Mailman." And then they go on to try to translate greeting cards. "Avoid Oh, here's one. Such behavior requires hugging. This good feel is just for you. With you, my heart is flammable. And this is the one I love the most. I love you, okay? I expect forever.
I love that, too. It's perfect for February. Nice for a card. But, you know, this is so interesting because we're getting into aspects of world English that are fascinating. In the Philippines, there is a word, chancing, C-H-A-N-C-I-N-G, which is Philippine English, for putting the make on a lady, i.e. on a bus or a subway. And I think that's pretty expressive myself. And then there's one from Japan that sort of a piece with the ones that you were talking about from China. It's Christ One Piece, C-H-R-I-S-T-O-N-E-P-I-E-C-E. And what it is, it's an attempt to describe a priest's cassock.
Oh, goodness.
And it's quite prevalent over there. We used to be before English became as prevalent in Japan as it is nowadays.
We go now to Chesapeake to talk with Chris. Good morning. Hi, Chris. You're on the air.
Oh, hey, thanks for having me. I just had an opinion regarding the there is versus the there are debate, because I know that there are two shirts is grammatically correct, and if I were to write it out, I would write there are. But if I'm speaking really quickly, or just maybe even just at a normal pace, I would say there's two shirts. Like one of my professors described it as like the law of least effort. It's like where you would change the rules or something, fudge the rules to make something easier to say in the spoken part of the language. I know they do it in, like, French and Spanish also. I was just wondering what you thought of that.
I like that, the law of least effort. It certainly is. I think he may have been expressing a bit of irony when he was telling you that.
Thanks, Chris. All right, do you want to just go on to Irvington? Let's talk with Jenny. Good morning. Hi, Jenny. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi there. Can you hear us okay?
Yes, just fine. You have ready for my question?
I sure am.
All right. It just takes my breath away every time I hear someone say that somebody went missing. It's like it's a destination.
Yes, she's gone missing. They went missing.
Well,
I know.
What about disappeared, you know? I mean, just anything like that would be better than went missing. But I hear it on reporters every night when they tell us that somebody is, you know, gone.
Well, I hate to tell you this, but it's quite common in standard British English.
And, wow.
And they've gone missing, et cetera. I've seen it constantly for years and years and years. And I think disappeared is probably the shortest way of doing it. It's probably the nicest way. It's the most formal way. But, you know, the newscasts today are a lot less formal than they used to be when Walter Cronkite was up there.
Well, you see that in their clothes as well as their speech.
You should see what I have on the radio today.
But you're on the radio.
Yes.
So different. But I have a couple of others, if you have a second.
Sure.
You have to make them quick because we're trying to get to two more.
About the apostrophe, and I've noticed even on Christmas cards, I get things from the Smiths, and they'll put an apostrophe in it.
Yes, that was what we covered early.
Oh, okay.
Earlier.
Mm-hmm. All right. And do children diagram sentences anymore?
Not that I know of.
That was such a big help when I was growing up because, frankly, this is a civil, a social, and it can be a legal problem if you don't put a comma in the correct place.
Absolutely, especially in legal language, it's very important. I agree with you.
Yeah, it's a roadmap. Having rules like that is just like rules of the road.
Yeah, and it makes the language a lot more understandable to people if they do diagram and understand all the functions of the parts of speech.
Right. I think what your caller earlier said, everybody's in too big a hurry, and they just get blurt out things, and they haven't really thought about exactly how to say them correctly. But it's very difficult when you're getting directions from someone for something and they don't use correct English.
I agree.
That's right. Thank you so much, Jenny, for your call. from Irvington. And we go to Roanoke for this call from Craig. And we're just about the end of the show, so we're going to try to get Craig in, and we're going to try to go for John. What's your question, Craig?
Well, I realize it sounds like we've hit a vein here in a mine, but I did have a question to Ann, if she would mind commenting on two things that I've seen, and I call them diminishing superlatives and multiple reductions, such as kind of spectacular and three times less.
Oh, I agree with you completely. That's the short answer.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
I thought it was a unique adaptation in our language that just needed comment.
Absolutely, and I don't like it at all, so I agree with you.
And okay. Sadly, we have, as we bid adieu to you, Craig, thank you for the call. We have reached the end of the program. John, I know I tried to get to you, but will you please tune in again next week and give us a call? We'll try to get you in. That's all the time we have for this edition of Virginia Conversations. I want to thank our lexicographer, Ann Sukhanoff. What a treasure. Thank you for helping us preserve the English language. And I remember someone saying, you know, am I too old-fashioned? Or this is not about being old-fashioned. This is about preserving what's important.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a lot of fun.
On the next edition of Virginia Conversations, we commemorate Black History Month, and there will be much more as well for the next program. We hope you have a great week. In the meantime, we remind you to check out Virginia Conversations on Facebook. I'm May Lily Lee. Have a great week.
Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Virginia Education Association, the men and women working in Virginia's public schools. VEA, teaching, learning, leading. Online at veanea.org. And by listeners of this Virginia Public Radio member station. Listeners can hear this program again or access other Virginia Public Radio news content at virginiapublicradio.org. This is Virginia Public Radio.